From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am Hunter Deucing in Dallas, Texas, currently hiding in my bunker with my lawyers, guns, and money. And joining me in the wild outback of Australia, currently at his tire fort with his flamethrower fighting off Lord Humongous, there is Mr. Stuart Falk. Say hello, Stu.
Hello, and I've just actually got to say this before John comes on. I've actually just reimagined the Road Warrior Mad Max 2. The end scene is no longer carrying fuel, it's actually carrying toilet paper across the country.
That's what it's. Yes, indeed.
Yep. Hello from Crazy Land. Let's buy everything. Shame on you, Australia.
Yeah,
it's actually
a toilet paper fort. Which, you know, having a flamethrower on your toilet paper fork, we didn't really think this through. But yeah,
I actually saw a post from this guy where he said, "All you idiots who bought up toilet paper, I hope you get a small fire and your house goes up like a tinderbox." It's like, yep. All of you stockpiled like fucking morons. Oh, shame on you, Australia. You make me sick.
Ridiculous.
Anyway, hello.
And up in Colorado in his compound where he has bees that will attack you if you try to take his Purell, we have Mr. John Gray. Say hello, John.
Hello, everybody.
Hey, just before we start, I got a couple of things I want to say. First of all, I want to apologize for my effort on the Fletch episode, which I wouldn't even call an effort. It was just like, I listened to it the other day and it's like, oh, yeah. I was in a lot of pain, but I was not really there, so I'm sorry for that. I'm going to put more effort into this one, hence the notes I took for it. And also, this week we're not actually known as the Midnight Movie Cowboys. We're going to be known as the Wuhan Clan.
Yeah. He's the... What was it? How can we do the RZA, the JZA, and the...
Oh, SZA.
The SZA.
you can get your Wu-Tang name. There's a Wu-Tang name generator. If you just put in your name, you'll get your name. Mine was Erratic Assassin.
I like that. Erratic Assassin. Wu-Tang name generator. Hold on. I got to look this up.
It does exist. Yeah.
Name generator. Okay, here it is. Wu-Tang name generator. Let's see. Hunter Deucing. Enter the Wu-Tang.
Come back as Hunter Deucing.
Lazy-assed warlock.
There you go.
What the hell?
Lazy-assed warlock.
What's mine?
Okay, what's your full name? Stuart? It's Stuart, middle name.
You don't need to put the middle name.
Stuart Falk.
Yeah.
Quiet warlock.
Quiet warlock.
Let me see what happens if I put that. I'm profound destroyer. I like that better.
Yeah, that's better.
Profound destroyer. I am profound destroyer. Quiet warlock.
Quiet warlock. Quiet. Well, yeah, I can be, I guess.
Well, you were on the Fletch episode. You know, magic was there.
Yeah,
it was quiet,
true.
You know.
And I was actually a warlock because I was praying for a fix for my shoulder injury. But
anyway. So, you know, and you're feeling better now, right? So,
well, on the mend, I wouldn't say feeling better. The pain's certainly gone. That's why I was not on the episode with Craig last week, because I was like, at the last minute, I had to bail up going, ugh.
It felt the like magic worked slowly.
Yeah. And actually, you know what? With this coronavirus shit, you know, it didn't even hit me until the other night. I'm like, yeah, okay, you're all panicking. Until I got a message from the Hare Krishna temple saying we're shutting down as of Monday. I'm like, okay, now it's fucking real. It's like, oh, God, not my temple.
Well, they canceled Mass in Dallas.
Yeah, I saw you put that out there.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, my wife technically is a member of the Ordinariate, which is a diocese of North America. It's not part of the Dallas diocese, and their church was open, so we went there this morning.
Really?
But it wasn't crowded. You know, most people in Dallas didn't go to Mass today, so
I'm just praying that my Krishna temple, oh, not the temple, the restaurant that's about 10 minutes from my work is open still this evening, because if I don't, I'm stuffed for dinner. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do.
So, like, when you go to the Krishna temple, do you listen to Cro-Mags?
No, we listened to Shelter, the Mantra album.
Okay. I thought maybe John Joseph came and gave the talk.
Yeah, no, they just play like Message of the Bhagavad over and over on the loudspeaker. No, what they do is just like have the teachings, which you go and listen to for about an hour and a half. I usually go for about an hour, then you go have the free dinner upstairs, which is un-fucking real. It's insane. It's better than restaurant food. I mean, all vegetarian, obviously, but man, the... And for free as well. You get as many plates as you want. Yeah. I love the temple, but shit, being shut down. Fuck this virus.
There are benefits to atheism that no one will ever tell you about.
And
shut up, John, you fucking heathen.
Yes, you know. Yeah, religion gang. Stu, unite. Anyway, so...
Hey, you got your god, I got mine, I guess.
we're gonna fight. I'm gonna go on a crusade. It'll be cool. Anyway, today the movie we are covering is Cuckman 2. My wife took the kids. Cuckman 2. Michael Douglas is son of Cuckman.
Honey, he shrunk my masculinity. That's what it should be called.
Son of Cuckman.
The parallels between this and Cat and Mouse is insane. It's like
crazy. It's like the nuts. Same movie. So
yeah.
The movie we're really talking about is Falling Down, 1992, directed by Joel Schumacher, written by Ebby Rowe Smith, and starring Michael Douglas. And if you listen to our Cat and Mouse, aka Mousy episode. Which was our Kirk Douglas tribute episode, John pointed out very aptly that movie felt like that Falling Down felt like a spiritual successor to this, and that Michael Douglas was channeling his father. When he said that, it blew my mind because it's
me too.
Basically the same movie. It's about a man. I mean, he's not cucked in Falling Down the way he is in Cat and Mouse.
No, he's not cucked, but...
His wife's not sleeping with anybody, but she's left him and taken the kids. You know,
and I will say that Barbara Hershey is a fine specimen of a woman, much better looking than what Gene Seberg was.
Well, she aged quite well.
Oh, Lord,
compared to Tuesday Weld, that's for sure.
Which is a point in the movie.
Yes.
Like Robert Duvall's character mentions his wife lost her figure and everything.
Yeah, and Tuesday Weld, you know, if you've seen Thief, she was hot in that movie. But in this movie, you know, she plays Robert Duvall's kind of crazy wife, and Michael Douglas's character defense. his wife has left him and has taken their daughter. And he's a guy who he's a rule follower. He's a conformist, and his family has left him, and he's lost his job, which we kind of find this stuff out as the movie goes on. But the movie opens with him on the freeway, and the traffic is at a standstill. It's hot. There's tons of noise everywhere, and you see him just kind of lose it, and he just gets out of his car and walks off.
Yeah.
And just leaves his car behind. And actually, the screenwriter, Ebby Rowe Smith, plays the dude who's like, "Hey, buddy, where you going?"
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, it's the guy who wrote the movie. He's like, I'm more of a linoleum tile guy myself.
Oh, that guy at the start. Okay.
Yeah. He was actually an actor. He's only written two movies. This movie and Car 54, Where Are You?
Oh, no. God, no. Yeah. That's like electrical tape over the mouth, that one. Don't mention that one at all. It's terrible. Yeah.
Well, this would explain why the movie has so many, like, really good dialogue scenes, because he's an actor, and actors tend, you know, if they're writers, they're going to write really good acting scenes for characters. Yes.
Like Shane Black.
And, like Shane Black. And he said... He got the idea for this film. There were two things. One was he saw a news story about a guy in an 18-wheeler who was in standstill traffic who just snapped and started running cars off the road, basically like forcing his way through.
Yeah.
And he was like, he wanted to think like, gosh, what I want to get in that guy's head. And he said he also had a fantasy in standstill LA traffic of just getting out and walking off. And the movie sort of it you know, when I was watching it this time, it felt like a Western to me a little bit, because it's about Michael Douglas's character. He gets out of his car, he walks off, and he goes on this odyssey through LA. And it is, you know, I got to tell you, you know, at the time it was sort of the hidden side of LA that you didn't see in movies. Now, if you go to LA, that's just LA.
Yeah. It's just it
all looks like falling down now. But at the time it was like the hood, you know, it was like the Mexican and Korean neighborhoods. And, you know, his troubles begin when he goes into a Korean corner store. And it's a very famous scene where the Korean guy overcharges him for a soda, which 85 cents for a soda now is like, whew.
Oh, that's a deal.
What would it, brother?
Discounted
what
would it been? Walgreens.
Okay, I wanted to ask you, what would it have been back in 92?
50 cents.
It really would have been 50 cents. Okay.
Yeah, when he goes 50 cents, it's like that would have been the standard price. I remember when I was a kid, 50 cents got you a soda. Now it's like $2.
Shit, is it?
Yeah. It's way more now.
For high fructose corn syrup. Oh my god!
You have to go to Dollar Tree to get reasonably priced soda.
Yeah. You got to go to like the cheap stores.
And you guys don't even have proper sugar. You've got that high fructose crap.
Corn syrup shit.
Yeah, no, ours has still got sugar. Not that I drink sodas, soft drinks. No. Don't touch it. But I wanted to bring up something in this scene that I noticed, which is that picture I sent to my friend. Did you notice when Michael Douglas started berating the store owner, who named Mr. Lee, which, John, help me out, Koreans don't have a last name of Lee, do they?
It's not very common.
No.
That's like Smith in Korean is Kim, you know?
Yeah.
Right, yeah, but...
He should have been Mr. Kim.
Exactly, yeah. But there was a quick shot of Michael Douglas when he's berating the store owner. And there was a signpost behind him. Did you see what was written on the signpost? Like the street sign?
It was Corona.
Corona Street. I thought, oh my fucking god. I saw that. I sent it to her. I said, can you believe this shit? And she was like, oh my god. So, wow. I mean, yeah, the guy's not Chinese, but, you know, talk about irony.
But that actor is Michael Paul Chan, and he was on...
Rapid Fire.
he was on Rapid Fire. No, he was on Arrested Development.
I've never seen that.
Oh, it's great. And he was in Homicide Division. But he said that Joel Schumacher would workshop that scene.
Right.
At acting classes. And really? He said that the scene always lacked... something, because the people who would play the Korean owner would play it very they would be very passive.
Oh,
he said that what the role needed was he played it with aggression.
Yeah.
And if you notice, his character is very aggressive. Like, he's like, A-Fa-Set! And he's very like assertive. And he said that's what makes the scene tense, is that Michael Douglas is like, you know what, F you, buddy. You know,
yeah, exactly.
And I also love that bit where he's like, 85 cent? Is there like a V in there? Like, one of the things about this film is that it does not shy away from like racism at all. And it kind of dares to, like, Schumacher and Douglas talked about this, how it was like, you know, it was too edgy for a lot of the studios because it kind of dared you to sympathize with a racist lead, you know.
Yeah.
Even though, like, the film definitely does not condone him. In fact, Robert Duvall's character, the whole point of his character is to give you a flip side of the coin of a person who's gone through hell who has not cracked.
Right.
Robert Duvall is the cuck man in this film. It's not Michael Douglas.
Well, he is, but he's able to deal with what life gives him. He's a tough guy. Like Robert Duvall's character is actually like a legitimately very tough masculine character, I think, because he's had extreme tragedy in his life, and we'll get to that. But his character has has endured probably more horrific tragedy than Douglas's character has.
Yeah.
But he deals with it, and he, you know, is able to balance his life. But he does run away from certain responsibilities, and at the end he chooses not to run away from them anymore. Because he is, like you said, he's Cuckman. He is sort of hounded by his wife, but he gets over it. He manages to put his wife in her place by the end of the film. But
Tuesday World in this film was just unbearable. She was really, I don't know. I mean, I know why she's there, but yeah.
Well, she's supposed to be, she is there so you understand what Duvall is dealing with. He is about to retire from his job, which he clearly likes. So Duvall's character, just so we can set it up, he plays Sergeant Pendergrast, who's a cop who had a bad experience, and he's writing a desk. And his wife, played by Tuesday Weld, is clearly mentally ill, cannot handle existence, right? And she clearly has Pendergrast wrapped around her thumb. She can say, I'm having a hard day. I need you to come home. I need you to retire, because it's his last day on the job. And she wants him to retire. And he clearly doesn't want to. But he's doing it because she's such a pain in the butt that he's just going along with it. And in this film, he encounters a man who's very similar to himself, Michael Douglas's character, Defense. And he's like, this is what I could be, kind of. But yeah, so, you know, Michael Douglas, we have his character, Defense, going on a rampage across L.A. And it gets increasingly more violent and more terrible as it goes on. And we have this cop, Pendergrast, who is who's kind of pursuing him. But is his last day on the job, and he sort of finds and reasserts his masculinity in the film in a way that Douglas's character does in a more overt manner, but loses his life as a result.
Yeah. I will say, this film, for those of you who have never seen it, sounds like a white-knuckle thriller, and it's got moments like that. But you know what I found also? This film's very funny.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
I saw it as a dark comedy.
It is. It really is.
That now has more relevance than it did in 1993.
It's a lot of edgy humor. Yeah.
It's kind of like people who see Natural Born Killers as a comedy. I don't.
Natural Born Killers is very sick. It is occasionally. I think Robert Downey Jr. is very funny in it. But a lot of the violence in it is disgusting. And stomach turning, and I think Oliver Stone was kind of going for that.
I think he didn't get the joke. I always thought Oliver Stone took the Tarantino script too seriously and had it expanded that way.
You know, Stone is a weird guy because his movies are like late 80s through the 90s period of Stone. It's kind of like being grabbed by the collar and being screamed at.
Yeah.
And that's what's kind of cool about it, though. Like, I think after Alexander bombed, I think that's when his movies just totally lost all their venom.
I have said for the longest time, of that period of Stone, say, let's say from Salvador onwards, which I really like Salvador a lot. But let's say from Platoon onwards, when he really, you know, his career blew up. The one I like the most, the one everyone forgets about, is Talk Radio. I like that the most.
Oh, Talk Radio is great. I love that movie.
Yeah.
Probably his best movie.
I think so.
And you can tell a pair of guys who were very influenced by that were the Safdie brothers, because they put Eric Bogosian in Uncut Gems, and that is a very Talk Radio-influenced movie.
I need to see that. Everyone keeps talking about how good it is.
Yeah, Stu, if you like Talk Radio, watch Uncut Gems. You'll love it.
Adam Sandler, right?
Yep. Oh. Adam Sandler, and it's got Eric Bogosian in it as who's like the one Armenian playing a Jewish loan shark.
You know? Speaking of Armenians, who loves falling down a lot? He loves his movie.
Yeah, yeah. Of the MMC's resident Armenian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. His favorite scene that we'll get to later. He doesn't shy away from which one's his favorite scene.
I can't imagine what it is.
No, the hell you say.
But yeah, Talk Radio is a great Oliver Stone movie. I recently picked up the Twilight Time Blu-ray of it.
Oh, that's why I can't find it on Blu-ray. I've been looking for it, but it's like, yeah, not easy to get.
Yeah, yeah, but no, that period of Stone, though, is terrific. And this film kind of feels like it could fit in with that, even though it's Joel Schumacher.
Anybody feel like it's not like a Schumacher film? It feels so different from what he makes.
I think it has a bit of Schumacher in it that I recognize. Like, he loves Piers, for one.
Yeah. Did you say Piers? I thought you said something else.
No, Piers. Yeah.
Oh, okay, something else that rhymes with ears.
We know the something else he likes.
He likes that too. Yeah. But no, Joel Schumacher. It does feel like his work to me because. I don't know, just towards the end, the Venice Pier stuff, I mean, it's like straight out of Lost Boys almost. But also, like, his movies have a sense of humor to them that either works or doesn't, and it works here, and that he understands.
He can be a good filmmaker. I remember seeing 8mm, and that one shook me up.
Oh yeah, no, Joel Schumacher, when he's got the right material, I think he's quite good. You know, I like Lost Boys.
I've never seen it. I still own it. I mean, I own it on Blu-ray. I picked up for.
I mean, I've
never seen it.
The thing about it that cracks me up is when you watch it, it's a teen movie that's clearly made by a homosexual because. You know,
Corey Haim has a poster of Rob Lowe on his wall.
Corey Haim's room is full of Rob Lowe posters, and also, like all the kids are rocking out to like Beefcake Tim Capello.
Yeah,
like that thing, like it's just so funny.
It'll always, to me, it's always the best line in Reservoir Dogs. Where Tim Roth is the undercover cop is making up a story. He says, he's calling me. And I'm like, motherfucker, I'm watching The Lost Boys.
Yeah. And you know what's a movie of his that's really good is the Larry Cohen penned Phone Booth.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah, that was all right. Yeah, I remember seeing that. That was really short. It was like about an hour and 15 minutes or something. It was like
really short, but it's...
He had to prove he could make cheap films because Batman and Robin lost so much money. Oh, so he had to make some low-budget production.
That stained him for years, Batman and Robin.
Yeah.
Yeah, his commentary track, though, is for that movie.
It's excellent.
Fire.
Yeah, because he puts his hand up and says, yep, it was me. So, I mean, you got to admire him for that.
When he explains the process, though, it snaps into focus. You know, yeah. Everything about it, it's like everything that went wrong, it all makes sense. And he's just like, I knew what this was, and I signed up for it. But here's the process. You know, we make the molds for the toys before we shoot. Make it as toy, sell as many toys as possible. Toyetic.
Yep.
Or toyific or whatever.
Toyrific, wasn't it?
Toyrific. Yeah, yeah, it was. Something like that. But no, and I got to say, too, an unsung hero of this movie is the cinematographer, Andrzej Barkowiak, the guy who directed Romeo Must Die.
Okay. Yeah.
He shot this film, and he also shot stuff like Preetzi's Honor and The Verdict and Prince of the City and Lethal Weapon 4. And I love his cinematography on this movie. Yeah. It's hot, it's sweaty. It's got the colors are great, like when he's in the Korean corner store and the orange hue inside. And I also thought there was a shot in this movie that I think I could be reading too much into it, but this movie is kind of about the terror of modern life in the 90s anyway. And there's a shot in the film that reminded me of a very recent movie. And there's a shot where Michael Douglas is watching his home movies. When he invades Barbara Hershey's house and he's watching their home movies, and there's a purple hue on his face.
And it reminded me of Ryan Gosling in Blade Runner 2049 when he sees the holographic ad of his girlfriend towards the end, who's his holographic girlfriend who dies. And it kind of reminds you of the fake construction of life. And in this scene, he's watching his home movies with his family, but then you see him have a breakdown where he's like yelling at his wife to
put the daughter on the horse. That's the one moment there. Sorry, Hunter. That's the one moment there where I said, you know what? I kind of like Michael Douglas throughout the film. I was sort of rooting for him. When I saw that, I thought, you know, you are an asshole, because the kid's obviously screaming, doesn't want to go on the horse, but you're like, I bought the horse, put her on there. So it's a good moment because it does say that this guy's not a victim. He is also an antagonist. So
yeah, he's the victim of himself, and his family is victimized by him. But I know someone who said that their dad would do that. Would make home movies and would get angry and have them do alternate takes. You know, do it again. You know.
Jeez.
And it reminded me of that when I was watching it. But you know, the purple hue on Douglas's face, his damaged face while he's watching it, it reminded me of Blade Runner 2049, the Denis Villeneuve film, when he's got the purple light on his face and he's seeing his girlfriend's advertisement. And it reminds him of that his relationship was fake and his whole life is fake. And it kind of, you know, that scene in Falling Down, we find that Michael Douglas's version of what his family was is something that he kind of constructed in his head.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you think that shot, you know, where you were watching Douglas watch the video and all the happy moments were a figment of his imagination until you got to that point where he was screaming at the kid to get on the horse?
I don't think it was a figment of his imagination, but I think his image of his family, it's one of those things where he's gone, I'm a rule follower. I deserve this. I deserve the things I get. And I deserve a good family. Because I've always done what was expected of me. And I don't think it was his imagination. There's nothing in the movie that makes me think like, oh, he just imagined all of this. What I think is that it kind of shows how he was emotionally abusive and would try to create this image of a perfect family that he didn't really have.
Because when the cops were talking to Barbara Hershey, you could see she was holding back when he was going, was he violent? And she was like, she wanted to say yes, but she didn't want to say.
Well, she was like, he never really hit me, but I felt like he could. And when you see that scene, you understand what she means, right?
Yeah.
That he seems violent, but I mean, but also, you know, when people talk about extremely personal stuff like that, they're embarrassed. They don't want to rock the boat too much, I think, is part of it.
Yeah, through fear.
Yeah.
Yeah, no.
But and plus, you know, you never know at what moment he's going to show up.
That's right. Well, there's that moment when the cop, you know, he lifts himself up from the ground and through the window, and she has a fleeting glimpse thinking that it's Michael Douglas, but it's a cop because he's wearing the same sort of glasses as him. So right. She's obviously in fear of this guy, you know, showing up. Man, like the parallels between this and Cat and Mouse, the character and the distance from the family, the restraining order.
Yes.
I mean, Michael Douglas must have known it's the same as Cat and Mouse.
Well, you have to wonder if the screenwriter had seen Cat and Mouse and said, I want to write a better version of that, what I thought that movie should have been.
Because this is a way Los better Angeles movie.
And have Michael Douglas play the mousy role, but differently, you know.
And John, I want to know what you think of this. I was thinking about this when I was watching it. But, you know, I think of Kirk Douglas as an extremely masculine performer.
Yeah.
Kirk Douglas to me is like, you know, he's one of the most manly men that's ever been on movies. Michael Douglas, I do not think of him as particularly masculine. I think of him as sleazy.
Yeah, he looks sleazy and, you know,
He's Gordon Gekko.
Yeah.
He's the dude from Basic Instinct. You know, he's always kind of a greaseball.
And his dad looks athletic, and he is not.
Yes.
Know. Yeah, like he's Kirk Douglas. He looks like a bodybuilder, Kirk Douglas. He could have been a bodybuilder, really, if he had applied himself.
If he worked out. He never worked out the way.
No, but if he applied himself, he could have had a physique like a bodybuilder. Michael Douglas doesn't have that look at all.
Yeah. No, Michael Douglas is a little more schlubby looking. But I thought this is the movie where he most resembles his father.
Oh, it's ridiculous. Some scenes you look at it, especially with the glasses on, especially when he has the crack in the glasses, which I found when he has that crack in the glasses, when he actually cracks and just loses it.
Yeah, and that image, as you pointed out, John, in the cat and mouse episode is clearly lifted because it's the same thing.
It can't be coincidence.
He's got the cracked glasses. But Michael Douglas in this movie, I felt like this film is a role that his father would have taken if it had been written in the 60s or the 50s.
Yes. Oh, damn.
Because it has all the stuff his dad would have liked. It has a social conscience and an edgy social conscience, because Kirk Douglas loved social movies, but he liked them to have a little bit of teeth to him. Because the thing about Falling Down is that the scene with Frederick Forrest is in the movie so that you don't get the wrong idea about it.
Right.
Because it is a movie that people will watch and will identify extremely strongly with Defense.
Yes.
And because, let's face it, a lot of people find modern life to be a horrific drudge, a horrific slog, a extremely dissatisfying nightmare. I think more so than even the people who made this movie realize. But that Frederick Forrest character is there so that, hey, those of you who really buy into this, we don't want you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a scene in the film where Michael Douglas happens in on an army surplus store.
it's his favorite.
Yeah. When we need him.
Yeah, I know.
And Frederick Forrest plays this dude who runs the surplus store, and he is like loudly homophobic. He's like, hey, you buy these boots. These boots are great for stomping queers, you know.
Yeah.
And there's two gay guys in the store.
Yeah, there's two gay guys in the store, and they're like, you got a problem, dude? And so anyway, Frederick, this cop comes in looking for Michael Douglas, and Frederick Forrest hides him, figures out who he is because he listens to the police scanner, and then takes him back to like his Nazi lair.
It's full on. It's like, holy
shit. It's like Santa Nazis. It's like, it's Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS, like, you know.
Oh, yeah. It's Hollywood's idea of what a neo-Nazi skinhead is like.
There was actually a cut scene from there. Sorry, Hunter. There's a cut scene from that one where there was actually Frederick Forrest was living with another guy, and actually it was Lemmy who was in the movie.
No, yeah, it's like Hollywood cartoon Nazi land. And Michael Douglas is like, I'm not part of this. You're a sick a-hole. You know, like, I'm an American and I believe in freedom of speech. And, you know, this is where he distinguishes himself from the type of person we don't want getting the wrong message from this movie.
They tried to drum. Connor, I actually remember when this was released, they were totally trying to stir up controversy with the release.
They were, but Douglas on the Blu-ray talks about that scene and basically says exactly what I said, that we're trying. Like, I was watching it going, this is the scene where they're saying we don't really want Nazis getting the wrong idea about this movie, or that we don't want the Nazi audience to love this film. Michael Douglas goes, well, this is the character that takes it too far. You know, like, Frederick Forrest is the character who goes a little too far with it.
American History X, which is worshipped by neo-Nazis, skinheads.
Oh, I know.
They love that movie.
And that's why David Kaye was so pissed.
Yeah.
Because David Kaye was a Jew who made the film, and it was taken away from him by Edward Norton.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, because in the movie ended up being way more alluring because the message at the end of the film is, oh, you had your enlightenment? Well, so what? Boom, you're dead.
Yeah, Edward Norton, being an actor, he was so dumb he didn't understand the meaning of the film. He didn't know he made a pro-Nazi skinhead movie.
He did. And
dumb actor that should stick to acting and memorizing scripts. You
know, like David Kaye, no wonder David Kaye was so upset with it, because at the end of the film, Edward Furlong's character has this big awakening, but oh well, you still got killed by black people.
Because his skinhead brothers weren't there to watch his back. He was protected when he was in the skin.
No, he lost it because Edward Norton told him to walk away from that.
And he's a lone nice guy and he gets killed.
And so, like, you know, of course, like, the Jewish director is going to go, no, that's not what I was going for.
Jeez. That movie is the ultimate backfire of any studio film I've ever seen.
Oh, if you want to see some like weirdness, like look at David Kaye's reaction to having it taken away from him. Like he took out like black pages in Variety and was going to studio meetings with rabbis and stuff like that. It was very strange.
Wow.
Or, did I say David Kaye? I meant Tony Kaye. It's Tony Kaye.
Tony Kaye.
When did you guys first see this?
I saw this in college. And you know what's funny is I was also kind of amazed by how my viewing of it changed, because I saw it in college. And, you know, when I saw it in college, I was like, hey, defense, you know, super edgelordy type reading of the movie. Right. Mm. And then when I watched it this time, I actually really appreciated Duvall's character. And I was like, that's a character I don't think I appreciated when I was younger. Because I was more into the edgy stuff, you know, in college. And I thought Defense was an edgy character. But when I watched it this time, I was like, man, Duvall's character, you know, he's a guy who really goes through some dark stuff. But he maintains his composure. But I first saw it in college.
Did you catch this, John, at the theater when it came out?
No, I rented it when it came out on VHS. And that was the big... You know, rental was really how you started seeing everything at that time.
I actually caught this one in the theater when it came out. It didn't play very long, only for 2 weeks, I guess. I've actually still got the Daybill poster. I bought it when it came out in 92. I used to collect Daybill posters.
It was not a big hit in America. It was not a big hit at all, really. I think it was more popular in video.
Yeah, it's one of those.
A lot of movies,
a life on video.
Come and go in 2 weeks, but then you'd rent them like crazy because rental was still the big market at the time.
Yeah. But I remember the screening I went to was just like people. It was sort of like a third of the way filled, maybe a quarter of the way filled, and everyone walked out without saying a word. They couldn't understand what they'd just seen. It was
I think everybody was seeing Aladdin at the time, the Disney cartoon.
Oh,
it was the beginning.
Yeah,
most likely. And all that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I got to say that I the other character I did not like in this film was that cop who was partnered up with. Is it Rachel Tikkaton, I think her name is? From
Yeah, Rachel Tikkaton.
The one who gets punched out at the birthday party.
What is the point? He was a sore thumb in this. What was the point? What was he jealous of
for
Duvall?
Duvall to slug him out. That's what it was. It was for Duvall to slug him out at the end of drop the line that everybody at the station knew that his wife was a bitch.
Yeah. But it was kind of like he was sort of like a lost a point. With this film for me. So same with the police captain. I thought, you'd know this guy. You'd know his background. He goes, oh, the game of the file. How are the kids? He knows he would have lost a child. So, yeah. Yeah, those two characters. Tuesday, well, was just annoying. I mean, I get the point of her existence in there, but she was just annoying.
Well,
she's supposed to be
so that you understand why why Robert Duvall's like, I'm not going, I'd rather stick with this life-threatening case.
Did
and
you
at
notice
the end,
this?
you get the idea that he's gonna stay a cop. He goes, that he's gonna stand up to her.
Did you guys notice the Apocalypse Now moment in there? Obviously, from Duvall and Frederick Forrest being in the same movie.
Oh yeah, I forgot Frederick Forrest was in Apocalypse Now. Yeah.
There was the strippogram who came out named Susie Q. Name one.
Yes!
Same one from
Apocalypse.
Oh man,
yeah. I totally forgot about that. Oh.
Yeah, it's a total reference to Colleen Camp's. No, it was the other actress that was that stripper, the cowboy gear.
But yeah, that had to be
Susie Q.
So
Duvall is really good in this movie, though.
He was. Yeah.
He's an actor who I think just elevates everything he's in. You know, it's like Godfather Part 3. One of the reasons it's not very good is he's not in it.
No, of course. There's one film of his I really like. One that's like a buried film from 81 called True Confessions with Robert De Niro.
Mm, yeah.
That's a good one.
It's on Amazon Prime right now.
Over there in America, I dare say.
Yeah, I need
here.
To watch it.
Yeah, no, I remember seeing it on video tape years and years, but I remember it being really, really good. One of those De Niro films that just got lost in the mix, you know, amongst Raging Bull and other titles around that time. But one I'm sure you guys most likely have seen, Hunter, I dare say you would have seen, that I've never seen, called The Apostle. I want to see.
I really want to see that. I've never seen it. Duvall directed it, actually.
Oh, okay.
Andy Sims, that's a favorite of his. And he's, okay. You know, being an evangelical person, you know, that, but my wife, coming from an evangelical background, she comes from, you know, a very strong, very prominent evangelical family. That's a movie I've really wanted to watch with her in particular. So that's one I've never seen, but I really want to see.
Okay. I thought you would have seen it by now.
I know, yeah, you would think. You know, it's kind of stupid that I haven't. I need to watch it.
Yeah. Okay. You seen it, John?
The Apostle, I have not seen.
Oh, interesting. Might be a future one maybe we could do.
You know what's one my wife showed me with him, though, was Newsies. Seen Newsies?
No.
He plays a Pulitzer. Mr. Pulitzer.
Oh, God.
Yeah. What about the whole?
Hey, but you know what's a great Robert Duvall movie? Open Range, Kevin Costner.
Never seen it.
What the? John, come on, bro. You haven't seen Open Range?
I saw it, but I thought it was just okay when I saw it. But now everybody loves it like it's the best Western of the last 40 years. And
I saw it for the first
time. I said, I guess
time.
I got to watch it again because I didn't quite feel that way about it.
I saw it for the first time a few years ago, and I was blown away by it. I thought it was great. You know?
Mm. I didn't quite understand. I don't understand the big praise for it. But I just got to watch it again.
It's also in the masterpiece film. The only critic on Rotten Tomatoes who praised this movie was Steve Saylor. Mm-hmm. And that is Gods and Generals with Robert Duvall playing Liberty Lee. And he, by the way,
Turner's money, basically paying for a movie.
Yes, and it's basically Stonewall Jackson, the movie. But Robert Duvall is a 50 million times better Robert E. Lee than Martin Sheen in Gettysburg. Martin Sheen was awful as Robert E. Lee in Gettysburg, which is a decent movie, but he's a sore spot in that film. Robert Duvall, amazing Robert E. Lee. Stephen Lang, amazing Stonewall Jackson. You know,
good actor, Stephen Lang. Good actor. Yeah. Very, very underrated.
Gods and Generals, highly underrated. We should do a show on it at some point. It's very good.
I'll tell you my favorite.
Out eventually.
My favorite Robert Duvall film, though, which is one a lot of people forget because it's one of his early ones, which is THX 1138.
Oh yeah, the George Lucas.
Oh, yeah. The best George Lucas film, by the way. Still the best one.
Episode 3. Just kidding.
Whatever.
I like his performance on The Killer Elite. He's actually pretty a scary villain in that. It's that uneven film, though. Another uneven Peckinpah movie.
Hey, Great Santini.
Yeah, the Great Santini's terrific.
I gotta say it's a normie take, but The Godfather and Godfather Part 2. I mean, that's good stuff.
Even though he was miscast. I mean,
I don't think so. I think he's great in those movies, and the fact that he's not in Godfather Part 3, it really hurts that movie because he's so good.
And he said it was because they wouldn't pay him as much as they'd pay Pacino and other actors.
And back. and they'd pay him more to be
George Hamilton.
And, they'd pay him more to do Days of Thunder. You know, he went and did Days of Thunder instead. You know,
yeah. But Godfather 3, they could have cut out Sofia Coppola, taken her money, and give it to Duvall. She didn't need to be there. George Hamilton.
Did you know Duvall is a huge Bruce Lee fanatic?
Really?
Sense.
Yeah, like loves the movies, and I guess is like a fanatic for minutia. It's one of those weird things that you'd never know.
Imagine Enter the Dragon with Robert Duvall would have been interesting.
He would have played the John Saxon role.
Yeah, he would have been a great Roper.
Oh, Game of Death with
Robert Duvall.
He could have been on one of the seven levels that Bruce needs to climb. Getting back to falling down, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Falling down. You know. So, with you guys, what are some other thoughts you had on it, John, about the role of defense, kind of how you react to that character? Because he's sort of a character that has kind of an edgelord following, but what are some views you have on it?
When the film was released, Rush Limbaugh had a TV show that aired every night, and of course,
I remember
when
that
viewers
show. Did, I used to watch it with
when,
my dad.
Yeah, when I watched it every night in college because you weren't supposed to. You were told, "Oh, he's awful," and I'm like, "Oh, okay, I'll watch him then." But I think there were reviews that were constantly saying this is. I think there were negative reviews because I think it was a mixed reaction back then. They were saying this is like red meat for Rush Limbaugh's audience or something, and Limbaugh had talked about that review on the show, and he said he saw the movie the day before and he thought it was stupid. Like, he didn't like it, so he did not understand the big love for it or whatever, or them comparing it to his audience. He was taking apart the logic of the scenes and everything, and it's not, if you look at it politically, it's not conservative. It's not.
No, it's
even
not
really
it's...
lip.
Well, the only the only hint you get that defense is a right winger is the fact that he says he's building missiles to destroy the communists.
Yeah.
So.
And really, defense is a normie.
But he's ex-military. He's a military guy. Like, he has a Purple Heart on his mom's wall. You can see, like, you can read all the stuff. He's got. He's a military guy.
Oh, okay. I missed it.
So he'd been in the war. That's why he had.
He's a normie. No, I'm
kidding. Yeah. Well, that's why he had pretty good combat skills when he's dealing with the gang guys and he's, you know, killing Frederick Forrest's character without blinking, basically, because it implies he's a Vietnam vet and was pretty good at
guy,
it. Then.
That homeless guy.
I was just
going to
bring it up.
And he goes, would have been like 10.
I was just going to bring it up. Yeah, he's like,
yeah,
what,
exactly,
like 10?
Because he was a Vietnam vet. Defense is a vet.
Yeah. Oh, God.
It's not slapped in. You're not slapped in the face with it, but it's more obvious. Back then, movies just had to drop a hint, show you all of his military stuff, and okay, you knew he was a vet. You know, they let the audience figure that out. And so that's why he's actually really, like, when he beats the two cholos up with the stick, I mean, he knows what he's doing.
He's
not afraid
racist,
to be violent.
Man. He's such
that's
a racist.
That's another reason his wife's probably like, well, he's capable of it.
Yeah. I know.
And he's wearing glasses just like, didn't Charles Starkweather wear similar glasses?
Probably.
Those kind of Buddy Holly glasses, the Zodiac Killer.
Like,
and,
which
yeah,
are very,
cities.
Which are actually popular with kids now.
Yeah, Rivers Cuomo glasses.
No, these aren't Rivers Cuomo glasses.
No, wait, they're not.
They've got the top frames. Kids wear those today. Like, I see a lot of boys wearing those in high school.
Right, because, like, Drew Carey, I guess, kind of took defense's look when he started appearing on TV with the short-sleeve shirt. And
the whole Harry Potter glasses that kids were going crazy for. It's like, well, it wasn't so much Harry Potter as it was Bernard Goetz back in the 80s. It's like, you don't understand who was wearing these first. Like, guy who slain three black guys in the subway.
The Goetz incident inspired. Because we were thinking Bernard Goetz back then. Actually, back in 93 or whatever, I thought, oh, they must have been inspired by Bernard Goetz.
Yeah. There'd be a lot of
people. It's funny how that changes over time.
A lot of people have forgotten about Bernard Goetz, but and that incident, because there's been so much since then. But I remember seeing a dramatized TV movie or a two-parter called the Trial of Bernard Goetz, and the guy who played Goetz was the father from Elf, the TV show. Well, I can't remember his real name.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
It's actually not good casting in that case.
No, it's only because he looks a lot
like Richard Thomas.
No, but he looks a lot like Bernard Goetz. That'd be the only reason why. But, boy, I'd like to see that thing again. That was a VHS tape only. I've never seen it since then.
Oh, those are old TV movies that are actually hard to find on video.
Yeah. Oh, there's even one called The Trial of Lee Harvey Oswald, which was like a fictitious trial had Oswald live. Boy, good luck trying to find that.
Isn't that a Larry Cohen movie?
It's possible. I don't know. I don't know when it was made.
But I think that's like a kind of pulled Larry Cohen movie or something like, or it might have been a Larry Buchanan movie, which is a totally different animal. But I have to look it up. Look into that.
There was so many of those things. I mean, VHS. I mean, we can go on a whole rant about VHS, but my God, that had pretty much everything covered. I don't think there was nothing ever left to chance with that format. Nothing's ever beat VHS since. Quality wise, of course, it's been topped, but. Amount of releases. Easily.
Well, just in terms of availability, no. You know.
It was ridiculous just how much stuff you could get on tape.
But the movie, like, it's very much populist stuff. Like when he marches through the country club and he yells at the two rich white guys.
Oh, that's so funny.
You know,
yeah.
You know, this should be a park with a petting zoo and families having picnics here and stuff. It's like this total, you know, it takes this kind of populist slant there and everything. Oh, the cigar smoking golf club guys.
Hollywood like, movies really hate. They really hate those country clubs.
This is Hunter's running thing about country clubs.
You've only got to watch that skit that George Carlin did about country clubs and golf courses. It's lifted. It's literally that skit come to life.
I mean, like, you know, you watch Fletch, it has the same thing. You watch Caddyshack, it's the same thing.
You watch Caddyshack too. If you're daring, and it's the same thing.
It was funny that old guy was having a heart attack, and he goes, "Where's the pills in the cart rolling into the river?"
Like, don't you wish you'd let me play?
That's why back then I took it as a dark comedy. Then I thought it was just being a black comedy like Heathers. Yep. Murder is funny, or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly.
But looking at it now, it's like this statement on society from a you know, stressed out, overworked populist point of view, because there's a point where he says something about being he's overeducated and undertrained.
Underskilled. He says overeducated, underskilled, and not economically viable. Remember, there's the black dude outside the bank saying, "I can't get a loan because I'm not economically viable." But and then defense repeats that later. I'm not economically viable.
Yeah.
You know, Joel Schumacher was talking about how when this movie came out, Newsweek was when they were making it, Newsweek was running front page stories about the vanishing white male middle class. And, you know, my goodness, how that's accelerated in America. Also, Michael Douglas said when they wrapped the film, the Rodney King riots were going on.
Yeah, I saw that extra bit on the Blu-ray that he was talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
It was good as well that Schumacher and – I've not heard the commentary. I'm going to put the Blu-ray
– I listened to some of it. It's very old school in that, like, you get little snippets from different people in the movie.
Right.
You get, like, Schumacher, Douglas. You get the Korean – corner store owner, you get and this has been taken from like an earlier thing, so it's very much kind of piecemealed, but it's a good commentary.
But the thing is, as well, it's good that Schumacher and Douglas didn't try and bury it now because of the current climate that we're in and say, "Oh, I don't want to talk about falling down." They actively talk about it and not try and disown it, which you got to put your
and take actively from. Talk about that you could not make this movie today.
No hope.
No, absolutely not. Just the scene in the fast food restaurant right there told me it would not be made today with him pulling out a machine gun in a fast food, which I was surprised was made then because San Diego had one of the worst mass shootings in the 80s when a guy went to a, I think it was a McDonald's or some fast food restaurant, shot it up, killed like 20, 25 people.
Jeez.
God.
And he was one of these guys that went nuts and, you know, was gun collector. And I think he killed his family and then went to the fast food restaurant, shot everybody up. I think they've made like a, there's a quack, kooky conspiracy documentary about it, slamming the cops response or whatever. Well, but yeah, it was a San Diego shooting in 84.
When Duvall finally confronts Defens at the end, he goes, I know what you were going to do. You were going to kill your family and then turn the gun on yourself because you got nowhere else to go.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's interesting like how he kind of in-befores him there, saying this is what you were going to do. You were going to kill your family, and then that leaves you with no escape.
Yeah, the point of no return. You've gone so far, mm-hmm. you can't go back.
Yeah, it gives you that you literally have nothing left to lose.
Made the first suicide by cop in a movie that I've seen.
Yeah, it is a suicide by cop ending.
The ending's very similar to Dirty Harry as well.
They did Charles Bronson 10 to Midnight or Dirty Harry type of ending, which, you know, goes into the water after he's shot and everything. But it's almost like when he says that line, I'm the bad guy, you know, that which was in the ads from what I remember.
Yeah, I was going to say, for those of you who have not seen it, don't watch the trailer. It gives away way too much.
Yeah.
This is one of the ones
I've avoided.
That's probably
why I didn't see it in the theater, Stu. Seriously. Really? I think maybe I thought the trailer showed me the whole movie.
I don't think I saw the trailer. I just saw the poster, and I'm like, wow, this looks good. I mean, I like Michael Douglas. I still do, but he looks so different. And I had seen Cat and Mouse at the time, but obviously did not put the correlation together, possibly. I'm like, wow, you know, Michael Douglas looks like a, you know, looks cool in this. So I'm going to, I was going to movies three times a week.
I picked it up because of the cover of the DVD with him standing on
the
gangland area with the briefcase and the shotgun.
The Blu-ray cover that you and I got, Hunter, is fucking shit.
It's awful.
It's one of those ones that needs a custom cover made and like slipped out.
Yeah, it does. The DVD cover was better. It has him standing. It's the movie poster with him standing in the gangland area with the shotgun
background.
And briefcase.
Yeah.
It's way better.
It's way better. It's like a
iconic.
Yeah, it is iconic image. Yeah. People know what it is.
The Blu-ray cover is like just Michael Douglas's face with the cracked glasses.
It's one shade away from the Give My Regards a Broad Street cover.
Oh, yeah. Paul McCoy, awful.
It's a rip-off of the Straw Dogs poster.
Yeah, no, it really is. It is Straw Dogs.
It is too.
Very lazy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the Straw Dogs poster was good because it's just that close-up image of Hoffman at the time. But, yeah.
The cover's
not good.
That was a good poster, but you know when it's recreated in an inferior manner for a Blu-ray has a good poster already.
I want to go on a semi-rant here. Yeah. Sorry. No, this is diverting away, but this is getting back to posters. They're releasing the Blues Brothers on 4K, which, great, you know, whatever. But again, the fucking artwork is just shit. It's not the original poster, which is not much. It's only just John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. Every fucking release I've seen post-VHS has had Belushi's name above Aykroyd and vice versa. Yet the theatrical poster had the correct names of the correct people. Why are they doing this? I mean, I don't get it. It happened on the fucking... I think it happened on the Laserdisc. It happened on the DVD. It happened on the Blu-ray. Now, they've done it again on the fucking 4K. Fix it. For God's sake. It's small, but my God, fix it. I mean, thank God for custom cover sites that I'm on where people will say, you know what, fuck this. I'm just going to get the original poster and make my own one up. And the quality of them is actually better than what the studios are releasing. So
I believe it.
Oh, they are, because they actually care about... For instance, I've got one for Tightrope. The Clint Eastwood film. The one for the Blu-ray is shit. The cover is shit. And someone out there, I think it goes by the name of Star Dragon 9. He's a cool guy. I've spoken to him before. He makes great covers, like old retro VHS covers for Warner's and Universal and CBS Fox, and blows away the Blu-ray covers that the studios are putting out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, take some care, you assholes. You own the rights to the poster. It's your company. Warner Brothers, you own the fucking poster. Don't get cute. Don't get lazy. Just put the original thing out. I mean, my James Bond Blu-rays, the shit covers that came with them, I stored them all away in a file, in a folder. in a plastic slip. That guy out there, Nissen, I think he goes by the name of Nissen, N-I-S-S-E-N, on the Blu-ray.com forums. The ones he did with the original artwork, holy shit. Insane. Everyone who sees my bonds go, where the fuck did you get these? Are these imports? And they go, nah, they're just custom covers I printed up. They're like, these are fucking awesome. And they are. And that's how they should have been released for their 50th anniversary, whatever it was, not long ago. But
yeah, because the original posters look great. Like, some of them are done by Bob McGinnis, like I think Thunderball is. And,
yeah,
you know, there's no reason not to use those posters.
You, I mean, don't they understand that people walk into stores and go, holy shit, look at this version of, you know, the original Dr. No with the original poster. I want it just for that. Just give me that. I don't give a fuck what's on the disc.
There's some sort of corporate thing that's very much against illustrated posters. I don't know why. But it died out in the last 40 years, really.
Well, thank God we've still got
they
Rock and Roll High School.
Do illustrated posters.
Well, we've got Rock and Roll High School, the Shout Factory one with the steelbook with the original artwork. Yeah. Thank God. Yeah, it's a ripoff of Animal House. I get it. Oh, no, Animal House ripped off that one, didn't it?
No, yeah, no, it's a ripoff of Animal House.
Hang on, when was Animal House? 78 or 79?
It was 78.
Okay, Rock and Roll High School.
It was 78.
Rock and Roll High School. Rock
and Roll High School was a year later. And
yeah,
that became a thing. There's a lot of teen comedy posters that look like that. You know.
My God, there was one that came out called King Frat, which was an awful, awful movie. But it was a literal Animal House ripoff with the artwork. And it was just one of those
things. There's a bunch of them like that. Hamburger the movie. I think Hot Dog the movie had a poster like that. I think a lot of them did.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. But they're enticing to look at. I mean, you walk into a video store back in the day and go, wow, this looks like Hot Dog the movie you brought up just then. It's not a great film. Mm-hmm. It's okay, but the artwork was cool. Same with Up the Creek. The artwork was cool. You looked at it and you go, I want to see this. There's no desire these days to want to do that. You know, just, you think, oh. Okay, custom cover time, it looks like. Got to look for another one.
Mm-hmm.
And the Eastwood films are guilty of that. Guilty.
Clint's Blu-ray covers are terrible.
They're not good, yeah. You know, the Iger Sanction.
The DVD ones were fine.
Yeah, the Iger Sanction, I mean, which it's a film. It's okay. It's not one of my favorites. But the artwork, the original poster art, it was good. It was a drawing of Clint scaling the mountain. The artwork for the Blu-ray is just him. That's it. It's just him. With a background. Nothing. I mean, this is just... It's lazy. I mean, isn't there sort of quality control over there? They're doing anything at all about this?
They just don't care.
They don't care. No. They don't care.
There may also be something about maybe they think they'd owe the poster artist royalties. I don't know.
So fucking pay
them. And they don't
want
to bother to do that. And then, you know, it seems like they've already paid for it. They can do whatever they want.
Okay, so why are albums... Okay, so why are music... albums when they're re-released and re-released with the same covers? Why aren't they with... Why haven't we got Slayer's Rain in Blood with all that horrific artwork as it is? Just a picture of some Slayer.
I have a theory. I'll take a guess that when the artist did the movie poster, home video didn't exist back then. So he never signed a deal for the art to be used on videotape or DVD. Now, a lot of times, the art was used on the videotape. The early videotapes, they just... 9 times out of 10, they just slap the original poster on.
Yeah, they just put the poster on.
And I don't know if there were royalty claims during that with artists or commercial artists, and they started cutting back on that with DVD. I'm not really sure. I've also heard that video stores or places like Best Buy, they don't want stuff to look like an old movie. So if you take something like Louis Teague's Alligator from 1980, that was slapped on with a brand new painted cover of an alligator very recent to make it look like a new film, to make it look like Sharknado or whatever. You know, the old poster is nothing wrong.
I remember the old poster of Alligator. Yeah, you're coming out of the alligator jaws coming out of the sewer there. Yeah, I remember it.
Right. And it's just like, there's nothing wrong with those old posters, but they don't want, even though it's an old movie and it's only going to be bought by people who like old movies, they don't want it to look like an old movie. It's so stupid. But that's the way they think, you know. It's probably why we're in it with such a terrible movie market that we have nowadays. And we don't get anything even this edgy, and never will with anything like this again. So it's a strange thing. Yeah. Like I said, this movie, I think accidentally, it was accidentally more relevant than it was supposed to be.
Yeah, I think Michael Douglas even kind of talks about that on the extras.
I mean,
back then, the only person who talked about the shrinking middle class, other than those Newsweek covers or cover stories, was like Pat Buchanan. He was always talking about it constantly. That the shrinking middle class because of the way the economy is going. And NAFTA had not been passed yet. But that sort of outsourcing, that's where it really started. It became defense world like just a few years
ago. Well, because like they were talking about the Ebby Rowe Smith said that one of the, you know, he decided to add in because in LA they had all these missile factories that shut down after the Cold War ended. And it was kind of ironic because it's like you're out of a job because you did too good a job.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
And he was like, you know, just that sort of idea of, you know, you did a good job. So sorry, you get your pink slip, you know, and nothing to show for it was one of the ideas he put in there. But, you know, yeah, it was a small event that prefigured the complete decimation of the American white working class. Which is, you know, now strung out on opioids.
Yep.
Yeah. But I think this film's more pertinent today than it was probably back in 92.
Oh, for sure. That's why you're seeing more and more people.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, more and more people are, you know, watching the film and identifying with defense.
There's also a really cool detail I noticed. I think they're in the locker room, the police locker room. There's a bunch of kids' drawings all over the wall with the police posters. It's a ton of, like, you know, like the policeman's kids drew pictures for them, and they put them on the wall. It was a weird detail I noticed.
I didn't notice that. I'll have to go back and look at that.
Yeah, and then never noticed it before. I mean, I've only watched the movie once in pan and scan. Maybe I watched the Laserdisc. I watched Garo's Laserdisc once when I was in Boston. Maybe that's it. I think that's the only times I've seen the film.
Really?
And so seeing it tonight with the Blu-ray transfer and everything, I'm like, okay, now I'm noticing things I didn't notice before that I would have never noticed on the old formats. I might have noticed in the theater.
Yeah. Yeah, it benefits from the widescreen format, this film. It's really shot wide. So
very wide.
Schumacher's
movies were torture to watch on television in pan and scan because he was always a scope director. He always did everything in scope.
Even Batman and Robin? It was, wasn't it? Yeah.
I think it was. It may not have been just because it's a super expensive special effects shoot, but he went over budget. I imagine that was probably shot in scope as well.
No, I think it is. Yeah, it's scope because the first two Batmans were just standard format, like 185 from Tim Burton.
Yeah, Burton doesn't shoot scope often or ever. I don't think he ever does.
All the horror filmmakers have to shoot in scope because John Carpenter did it, so therefore it's going to work. You don't understand. You got to
shoot Carpenter and Argento. Yeah. That's all they want to do.
Shoot it accordingly. Like we mentioned many years back when we watched Lords of Salem, didn't need to be shot in scope, Rob Zombie.
Nah.
Wrong format.
Hitchcock never shot in scope.
Nah.
I think maybe once or twice, but I don't think he ever shot in scope.
Didn't hurt him. He only ever shot, just flat.
It is for snakes.
Yeah, Howard Hawks hated it. He used it, but he hated it. He goes, it's good for snakes and coffins. And
don't mention snakes. If it wasn't for snakes, we wouldn't be in this fucking situation we're in now worldwide. This goddamn pandemic.
Oh, yeah.
Well, guys, what do you want to rate Falling Down? I'll go first. I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. I think it's a quite a solid thriller, more relevant today. Definitely highly recommended from me. John, what about you?
I'm giving it a good 8. I think I might like it better than – I think it was unfairly compared to stuff like Death Wish or Taxi Driver. But I actually think in many ways it's better than those two.
I think you might be right.
Because I think he's a more sympathetic.
Both of those movies, Death Wish just isn't a very good movie, full stop.
No.
But
it's pretty flat.
But Taxi Driver, you know, Taxi Driver has, it does have a morality at the center of it, but it's, you know, Travis Bickle is pretty despicable.
He's a creep. He's an absolute creep.
Yeah, it's just a defense you can actually sympathize with him. And it also has a moral center with Duvall's character that you can latch on to. So, yeah, you know, I think you're probably right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Stu, what about you?
I'm going to give it 8.5. I really, really enjoyed it again. And it still holds up nearly 30 years later. It speaks a lot more these days than it probably did back then. So, yep, 8.5 from me.
For sure.
I have a scary feeling it'll be even better in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Which
I think so.
I hate to think that, but you know, I don't.
It just gets better with age, and that's not a good thing.
Yeah, and it wasn't meant to be. It's accidentally great.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of great movies are, you know.
Yeah. Jaws.
A lot of movies that are attempting greatness are not that great, and a lot of
Halloween is a complete accident.
Yeah, exactly. This movie, a lot of the great movies are workman jobs that, you know, happen to be fantastic.
Yeah,
yeah. I don't think Joel Schumacher related to this material. I think it was just he saw it as a job and he probably shot it quickly. Like, he was notorious in the Warner Brothers a lot for shooting stuff quick and making it look good. Like, he didn't take anything personal.
For sure.
And that is when he got Batman and Robin was when things got out of hand.
Yes. But, you know, the paycheck was big and, you know, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
But was the paycheck worth the bullshit?
I read he shot Lost Boys in like 3 weeks or something, like record time.
Yeah,
it's a good movie.
It would have been quicker than that if Corey Haim and Feldman weren't so fucked up on drugs and trying to get him on set every day.
Probably.
Oh, yeah, there was a lot of problems with those two. Yeah. That was his thing. I remember Feldman saying Schumacher likes to shoot quick. He wants his shit done, in and out, gone.
Yeah.
His film's not his boys, I mean. So,
Well, anything you guys want to add about Falling Down before we hit the old dusty trail there?
Not about Falling Down. I do want to give a thank you to one of the listeners / friends of the show. Anson Matthews turned me on to a band called Messachups, who are like a voodoo surf psychobilly band. Had no idea who they were, and he's like, here, check it out, think you might like it, and got hooked on those pretty quick.
He turned me on to the OCs, and I have some students that are really into them.
Yeah.
So it's pretty cool.
Check out the album Mondo Harp, the new one by Mr. Chups, come out the other about a month or so back, and The Incredible Crocker Tiger. On Spotify, they are over here. I guess they would be over in the US if you're over there, or the UK, wherever you're at. Can't recommend them enough. Didn't know where they were from. Thought they were from the US or maybe Japan. Actually, turns out they're from St. Petersburg, Russia. So, there you go.
Hmm.
Yeah, but Messachups. Awesome. Can't recommend them enough.
Indeed. John, what about you?
Nothing really acknowledge. Quarantine has taken up our whole mindset these days.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Quarantino.
And I work for the government, so, you know, that makes it even messier.
Indeed.
That means my work mail is loaded with messages from Washington and stuff, so they're telling us all sorts of... They're not telling us any more than you're already hearing. And besides, half the planet will be wiped out and by the time it's released.
No, it does.
Cool.
Bullshit. You've got to put people really scared out there with morphine. Don't say that sort of thing. We'll be fine, people. Right. Don't worry about it. It'll be all right.
Oh, but we don't have apes working as our servants, so I'm not too worried right now.
Apes together strong.
Sheesh, I even...
No!
Rise of the Planet of the Apes now?
No! But, yeah, people, go crazy, stock up on toilet paper and dried noodles and do what the rich people want you to do. They're all laughing. Someone out there is really laughing. People out there are laughing at this hysteria. It's It's all planned. It's all planned hysteria. Yeah.
And it's, you know, a way to pass new taxes on us. Hey, you know what? Spend more time with your family. Hang out with your kids. Make the best of it. Catch up on your reading. It's all good.
Yeah, I'm just catching up on movies, video games, books. You know, it's all good.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, people here now being told they may be off for a month from work with no pay. Now, that's fucked.
We're getting hit in my house with that, so, you know.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, Jesus Christ. It's just, But did you guys say that thing that someone had written in a book? Was it Dean Koontz? Had written in a book years ago. It said in 2020 there'll be a virus that will spread and no sooner will be here, it'll be gone. And
it's now, and now you can't get that book off Amazon without paying a fortune for it.
Oh, really? Oh, it's online.
First time anybody's cared about a Dean Koontz book in large numbers.
There's one guy who's never had films made from his books, or barely ever.
There was like Odd Thomas, and that's it, you know.
Yeah.
Well, Harvey Weinstein, the Weinstein company, like Miramax, did Watchers and Phantoms, I think, or somebody Phantoms. Else did Watchers.
Phantoms was a Dean Koontz.
Ben Affleck, a couple of TV Phantoms. Movies. And Demon Seed, made in the 70s with Julie Christie, was a Dean Koontz novel.
Okay. Yeah.
There's a lot. I don't think he doesn't. The stuff he writes is probably not very cinematic in many ways, or it's too similar. They're too similar to each other. When I was reading him, it seemed like every book was just like the other one.
I've never read one.
I can't recommend it. Just not a writer I recommend.
Oh, well, here we go. This Trial of Bernard Goetz is on DVD. There you go.
Oh, my.
$25.99. Well, that's... There you go. Didn't even realize it was available. I would like to see it again. Been many, many years since I had, 2 and a bit hours. That sounds right. Yeah. Anyway, I'm done.
Yep. All right, guys. Well, if that's all, I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
And I'll say, what's wrong with the streets?
I'll say Metal Pig.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.